What's up, Playlisters? Brian from Playlist Wars here. Just want to let you know that while this show is on hiatus, both Gomez and I have separate shows that are part of the Playlist Wars extended universe, if you will. Gomez has the Sleevey G Show, which you can find at SleeveyGPodcasts.com. And I have a new show entitled My Weekly Mixtape, which you can find over at MyWeeklyMixtape.com. Both shows are also available on all podcast platforms just by searching Sleevey G Show or My Weekly Mixtape. And Playlist Wars will be back soon. Thank you guys so much for your continued support of the show.
Hey, this is Melissa Boilo from the Songs from the Attic radio show, and you are listening to Playlist Wars. Let the battle begin.
Welcome to Playlist Wars, everybody. I'm part of the dynamic duo. My name is Gomez, and I have my partner in crime, Brian Colburn. And with our special guest tonight, legendary drummer, Liberty DeVito. How is everyone doing tonight?
What's up? What's up?
What's going on here? Legendary. I like it.
It's absolutely true, Liberty.
It is.
We have been fans for decades, and I will tell you right now, I am so excited to talk music with you because you are truly one of my favorite drummers of all time. And I will try my hardest not to gush too much tonight.
If anything, that I can tell you, Brian was gushing all day since 7 a.m. this morning.
Well, gush away. Gush away. I like it.
So tonight, our topic is the iconic Billy Joel live album, Songs in the Attic. An album that was released on September 14th, 1981. Now, unlike many live albums of the time, it placed a focus squarely on the songs that Billy and the rest of the band felt were overlooked from his first four solo albums, Cold Spring Harbor, Piano Man, Street Life Serenade, and Turnstiles, the latter of which, Liberty, was your debut with the band.
Yeah.
So having played on all of Billy Joel's studio albums from Turnstiles all the way through the River of Dreams, as well as a bunch of live albums, how does Songs in the Attic resonate with you some 40 years after the live album's initial release?
Well, you know, I've never been a fan of live albums. I don't like them. I like to hear recorded songs, you know, because there's, you can hear things clearer and stuff like that. So when you guys asked me to do this interview here, I went back and listened to it again. You know, and I told people, I said, oh, yeah, they want to do, we're going to do Songs in the Attic. And they were like, Miami 2017. That's it. That's the one for me. That's the best version ever, ever. So I listened to it, you know, and it's like, you were right. It is the best version ever. You know, I mean, it's a good album. It really is a good album. I didn't realize that, you know, when you do something, like I'm sure the Beatles, when they did Sgt. Pepper, they thought, yeah, that was a good album. Let's move on. You know, and you move on. I mean, the one after it, what would we do? Nylon Curtain next was after Songs in the Attic?
Songs in the Attic, I think, was Glass Houses was followed that up, correct?
No, I think Glass Houses was first.
Hold on. Let's see. Glass Houses was 1980. Nylon Curtain was 82. Songs in the Attic. You are absolutely right, Liberty. It was the Nylon Curtain.
How dare you question
me? How dare
me?
I? You were there. How should I? Why should I?
I think I was there.
Playlisters, I might say we might be losing a co-host tonight with this.
I'm moving into his spot.
You got it, man.
You got it.
Take over.
Oh, my God.
Well, earlier today, Liberty, you posted about an excerpt from your book, Liberty, Life, Billy, and the Pursuit of Happiness.
Yes.
And you explained that the album's original title was Foam the Runways?
That was the working title, was Foam the Runways. Because I don't know if you know this, but I don't do it anymore, was when a plane was coming in for a crash landing at an airport, the fire trucks would go out and put foam all over the runway. So it would kind of, if it caught fire, the foam would put the fire out of it. So we were so burned out after the tour for recording the songs in the attic that we thought, like, Foam the Runways, man. That's it. We're coming in for a crash landing. So there's pins. I mean, some woman, Susie, posted one of the pins that we had, Foam the Runways. It's posted under, if you go down and read the text that people wrote, there's a copy of the pin that was Foam the Runways.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, let's get down to business, guys. I'm ready to talk some songs in the attic tonight. But first, if you're liking what you're hearing on Playlist Wars and you want to support the show, please consider becoming a Patreon member. All you have to do is head over to patreon.com/playlistwars and select a tier that works best for you. Like I said before, tonight our topic is the iconic Billy Joel live album, Songs in the Attic, and we've each individually created a mini playlist with our top four favorite songs from the album, none of which have been shared between the three of us prior till now. Throughout the episode, we'll each reveal our track one through track four, one by one, crafting what we each feel is the perfect Songs in the Attic playlist. After the episode, we turn it over to you, the amazing playlisters, to vote at PlaylistWarsPodcast.com to decide once and for all which one of us got it right. And while you're at PlaylistWarsPodcast.com, you can also listen to each one of our playlists just in case you want to hear where we're coming from with our choices. Now, Liberty, as our special guest this evening, you're used to counting the band in, so why don't you kick things off with your track one?
Track one. Like it is on the record, Miami 2017. To kick off an album, the energy is so high that when that song is over, you want to hear the rest of the record. You know, and I think the performance is really a lot better than it was on Turnstiles. You know, this was like, oh my goodness, you know, Billy hitting notes that are in the stratosphere and some of my drum fills. I was listening to it just the other day, and I thought, who's this kid that's playing drums on this track? Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, it's a good song. I was around when that happened, you know, the whole thing when Ford tells New York to drop dead.
Wow.
And so I remember that stuff. So, yeah, I like that song. I just think the end is a little boring. It keeps going. It's like, why couldn't it just end? Boom, you know?
Well, my track one is actually Miami 2017. Just like you said, the opening of this album was unreal. I love the way how Billy comes in with the piano, but within the minute and 29 seconds, because I actually was trying to listen to when you just popped in with the drums, it was just electrifying. You just hear you. The electrifying of the song, of the drumming, the piano, the way everything was going fits a perfect song. So that's what I opened up to, track one, Miami 2017.
Good.
Well, well, well. Recorded June 24th, 1980 at Madison Square Garden. Folks, we have a bingo to start tonight. Of course, I'm opening with Miami 2017. When we recorded the Billy Joel episode, episode 17, with Melissa Boilo from the Songs from the Attic radio program, I said that Miami 2017, the version from Songs in the Attic, is the definitive version of this song. And I'm going to repeat that tonight. As much as I love the version on Turnstiles, in listening to the Turnstiles album, I feel like this version just takes it to a stratospheric new level. And Liberty, you have this unique perspective on the song. You played on both the studio version as well as the live version that we're talking about. And like you, normally I'm a studio version guy. But having played both, I'd love for you to be, if you could, maybe compare what the vibe was recording it for Turnstiles to what it was in Madison Square Garden playing the version that is Songs in the Attic.
Well, there you go. First of all, recording it for Turnstiles, there was just three of us in the studio, me, Doug, and Billy. That was it. The guitars were overdubbed. This is the point when Billy said, well, we need guitars on this song. And then me and Doug said that we know Howard Emerson and Russell Chavers. So the band Topper that we had, me and Russell, Doug, and Howard, that's when we became Billy's band. That's when that happened, Miami 2017. So, you know, you play in the studio and you play safe. You do things that are really safe. So compared to the live version, of course, Madison Square Garden, we're home. You know, it's everybody wants to play there. So we're playing Madison Square Garden. And when you play live, then you can add more things. The great thing about our live show was that people who liked the record would bring somebody who really wasn't a Billy Joel fan to a live show. Once that person came and saw us live, they became a fan. So that just showed us that we were able to push our sound off the stage right into the crowd, you know? So that's what I really feel when I hear Miami 2017. It's like, wow, you know, it was fast. It was energetic. It just has everything, you know?
It's an iconic song, and I am so glad to see that we're kicking things off all in agreement. The perfect album opener for Songs in the Attic. So, Liberty, we are back to you now for track two.
Oh, my God. Okay. I like, this is tough. I don't know if it's going to be track two, track three. I like Los Angelinos, and I would choose it as track two because it's different in tempo than Miami 2017. So that's why I thought it would fit right there because, you know, I really like the track. I like it because it came from, I think, Street Life. It was on Street Life.
Yes, sir.
And when I had to listen to all the songs before I auditioned for Billy, I particularly liked that song. It was the first time I saw them. I heard people from Los Angeles called Los Angelinos, you know, and the whole thing about how they seem to be like foreign. They have a whole different life. You know, coming from New York, the furthest I traveled up to that point was to Detroit when I played with Mitch Ryder when I was 18 years old. So that was still a rock band, you know, that just kicked butt, you know. But this is like hearing about people from California, and Billy really nailed it the way it was back then in the 70s, how you looked at people, you know, hiding in garages, exotic massages, all that kind of stuff. That's what you thought of Los Angeles at the time. You know, everybody's living free and, you know, craziness. So, yeah, that song was a lot of fun to play because it was almost like when you're playing it, you're kind of making fun of these people that they're like ooh, wow, people like tree huggers and stuff like that. Yeah.
truly great song. It did not make my list, but I love that song, too.
Yeah, here's where the guilt comes in. I'll be perfectly honest. This was bouncing in and out with another song that I ended up going with. I love this version because there's this, I don't even want to use the word funky element to it, but I guess it's maybe the keyboard that Billy's playing in this song. It's different and it stands out because it's not the grand piano. So that electric piano or whatever he's playing in it adds almost a funk aspect. I know it's not a funk song, but it gives it that kind of vibe that really sets it apart from the other songs on the album.
Yeah.
So my question for you with this one is, you didn't play on the studio version.
No.
So what did you do to try to bring your own personal touch to the song? Because there is a difference between the version on Songs in the Attic as well as Street Life Serenade. So I'm curious how you and maybe the rest of the band at the time transformed it into the version that you hear on that album.
I think we took it more into a rock feel, and it really, you can hear the separate parts that are on, like Billy's plays the while the guys are going dan, da, 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 and I'm just playing straight ahead like goosh, da, goosh, da, you know, so it's got that whole like push, the great organ solo in it, you know.
Amazing.
Richie played organ in that song and stuff, and it was great. You know, the band just rocked it out instead of it being kind of flat the way it is on Street Life. So
definitely, definitely. And there's no disrespect to the version on Street Life either, but you could tell when you listen to the two back to back that one is a musician with backing musicians, and the other version is a band, a cohesive unit. And that is what the Songs from the Attic version is. That is the band speaking as one entity. And it just comes across as much more confident. And I'm not saying that Billy wasn't confident on the studio version, but there was almost a bravado that came out of the delivery in that song. And I absolutely love it.
Yeah, good one.
Gomez, we are now moving on to you for track two.
So track two, again, the guiltiness of not picking Los Angelinos is kind of hard. Because it would have went well with my theme of songs here, but I went somewhere else. But I went with, in that album, it was track six, Everybody Loves You Now, performed July 23rd, 1980 at the Bayou of Washington, D.C. I'll tell you, I love the beginning of this song where you hear almost like with the guitar playing, almost sounds like a banjo, but it's not. It's a legit guitar. And then hearing you, Liberty, playing the drums in the song, it just made it for like a really, not like a folk song, but like something a little more heavier. I can't find a word for it, but it was just a truly great song, which I loved. That's why I went with track two, Everybody Loves You Now.
Well, Gomez, I like where you're going with that, because that is also my track two. As much as I feel Cold Spring Harbor is extremely underrated and sometimes overlooked in his studio albums, I can't help but feel that this live version, again, is the definitive version, because there's an angst and a flip nature to the lyrics in this song. And the band was able to take that to new levels. And dare I use this word, Liberty, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel that the song almost brings a punk vibe to it because of the way Billy's singing it and what you're doing on the drums. I don't know if you're doing double time on the hi-hat. I was actually going back and forth with the drummer in my band about this song, saying this is 4/4, but what Liberty's doing is, it just sounds like there's so much going on and it's so aggressive and so drums forward. And that's what I love about it. Totally a 4/4 song, right? He goes, oh yeah, dude, if you tell Liberty it's not, he's going to hang up on you. I said, of course. So, but I'd love to know, because it feels much more, again, aggressive than the Cold Spring Harbor version. Was that something that you guys did naturally as you were playing together, or did it something that as you played it more and more, it just kind of gravitated to the version we're hearing on Songs in the Attic?
Well, the song itself is Billy, like it's almost a nasty song. Like he's telling this girl, you know, so it was time to get nasty. The song is done like this in 1, 2, 3, 4. But I'm playing like this. So I'm just pushing those boom, you know. So you're getting like a halftime feel while you're still getting that, you know, which builds this excitement and really makes it snobby, like you. B-I-T, you know. You know
what I mean? Did Everybody Loves You Now make your playlist tonight?
It's the next one.
All right. So that is your track three.
Yeah. Because I really do like it. And I, you know, with the Lords of 52nd Street, we do play it, you know, and it's a lot of fun to play because, like you say, it's like I'm in halftime, but I'm free to do like fills. A lot of fills and stuff like that, which keeps it moving, because it is just a through the whole song. So, you know,
and I feel like your drums are what bring it to that level. And it's some of the stuff that you do on the drums that I feel like if your drums were not in those songs, I feel like it would be taking them back a level, because your drums have a style about them that I've always felt is very musical. Because it's not just keeping a straight 4/4 beat like a Ringo Starr did, where he just kind of stayed in the pocket. You just kind of bring these elements of the song out with nuances of hi-hat lifts and snare hits at the right time and fills that really emphasize parts of the song that normally most drummers, I would think, would not go to emphasize. And I really, that's what I love about your style so much.
Well, I think that what you're saying with the drums, what I did with Billy, is what you would normally hear a guitar player do in a band.
Yes.
They do the licks that come after the vocal. Well, I was doing the licks because the guys are just playing the rhythm parts, you know? So, yeah.
Well, I absolutely love it. And we have our second trifecta of the night. Everybody Loves You Now. Now, before we go to songs 3 and 4, because we already have Liberties, I do want to just take a little bit of a pivot here to another question for you. I wanted to bring this up because of the recent passing of Meatloaf, which happened just this past month. You played several songs on the Dead Ringer album, Read 'Em and Weep and Dead Ringer for Love, which featured Cher. I'd love to know the experience of working with Meatloaf and Jim Steinman, because I've read so many stories about how meticulous they were in the studio. I would love to know from someone who has worked with them what that experience was like, because there's just tales and tales of how particular they were about how everything needed to be absolutely perfect and how that compared to what you did with Billy Joel's band.
Well, it was kind of the same thing. I mean, Jim Steinman had the song laid out. You know, he knew where the parts were going to be and what it was going to be like. And what I was told was, we just want this to be a really, you know, I mean, Rock and Roll and Brew. What was the name of the song? Is that the name of it?
Dead Ringer for Love.
Dead Ringer. Dead Ringer. That's the one. They sing Rock and Roll and Brew.
Yes. Right?
Okay. So Dead Ringer was like, we want this to be a rock tune. Rock tune. And don't forget, in the room with me is Davey Johnstone from Elton's band. And these other guys that I think Roy Bittan was on the piano or something. And it was crazy, the session guys. But when I heard Davey go, that whole beginning, it was like, okay, we're going for it. And I just put power behind it because it was a rock song. I gave it so much power, and we played so loud for that song that they had to shut down the session in the room next to us because they could hear us through the wall, which was very rare. Yeah.
That album is so underrated because everyone automatically goes to the Bat Out of Hell albums. But
right.
I feel like Dead Ringer is a ridiculously underrated Meatloaf album. And I just knowing that he passed and knowing that we were talking tonight, I had to bring it up because you had a chance to play with him and rest in peace because he was truly one of a kind musician.
No, he was great. It was easy. I mean, it was just like, you know, being with Billy, you know, just come up with something. Think that's why you're here. Think of what you would do, you know.
Now, was it the same when you were playing with like Stevie Nicks and Karen Carpenter? Was that more, here are the songs, we want them played a specific way? Or did you have a little bit of liberty to do what you want? There's no other word. Would you free reign to do what you wanted to do?
Well, you know, there's always free reign, you know, in arrangement of where the songs are going to go and the part that you're going to play. But like Karen, the person, you play to the person too. You know, like, you know, Meatloaf is sweating and he's singing and his hair is flying all over the place. So you can rock it out. Karen was a delicate little person, you know, that her voice, when she sang, was just so beautiful. So you kind of get a little more sensitive and that kind of thing. And the songs that she chose were kind of like dancey and poppy. And that was cool. Playing with Stevie Nicks playing live, that was a trip because coming from New York and then playing with other than Roy Bittan being a New Jersey guy, playing with those guys out there in LA, like Waddy Wattel and those people out there and Stevie, the first thing she said to me was, we're women and we're like delicate butterflies, so treat us easy. I was like, oh boy, this is going to be a problem, you know, because I was the, you know, you saw me play live with Billy, smacking cymbals, breaking shit, and, you know, and it's like, she just told me to calm down, yo. I can't stand it when somebody says, calm down. You know who did that too? What's his name that did Footloose? Who did Footloose?
Kenny Loggins.
Kenny Loggins.
I did this thing, Little Kids Rock, and he was a guest performer. And we're doing Footloose. And of course, you know, you're going to go for it, right? Footloose, come on. He turned to me, he goes, listen, I don't want any of that 17-year-old adrenaline bull. Just calm down. I was like, I said, come on, man. Kevin Bacon's dancing on top of the car. Are you kidding me?
Oh, man, that's great.
That's amazing. Now, before we get back to Songs from the Attic, I have one question that's been on my bucket list questions to ask you if I ever had the chance since I was a child and I first got my hands on the concert cassette, which was the album that you guys recorded in Soviet Union in Moscow. And that is Angry Young Man. Musically, like you had said with Everybody Loves You Now, I feel like your drums are truly the main, except for Billy's manic, like on the piano, you are literally complimenting him going back and forth with the drums, that whole opening to that song. I just have to ask, why did that not make Songs in the Attic? Because to me, that's the one song that is missing from this album, from ones that didn't get enough. Like, I know Angry Young Man is a fan favorite, but it was never a hit song. But to me, that would have been perfect for this album because this album is a lot of non-hits, stuff that people should know but didn't. So I'd love to know why that wasn't.
Well, I think Angry Young Man is more than the other songs. It's more a visual. When you see it, it's better than just hearing it. You know what I mean? Like the stuff that's going on there, it's funny because everybody says, why do you do that thing on the hi-hat real fast? It's because Billy needed to stay in time. So I had to play on the hi-hat to do that. So he stayed in time, you know? So, I mean, it's more of a visual thing, the smacking of the cymbals and all that kind of stuff. When you hear it, it's cool. But when you see it, it's even better. So we recorded everything we played every night. Everything was recorded, not just those particular songs. The whole shows were recorded. So who knows? Maybe one day Billy will put out Songs in the Attic 2.
Oh, it would be amazing.
That would be awesome.
I have the Moscow Blu-ray. And every time I put that on, I sit there in awe watching that opening song. It's just so amazing and so powerful what you guys were doing. And kind of watching the crowd, not knowing what to do at the beginning of that Blu-ray. And then by the end of the night, they just took over the place. That must have just been the most surreal night of all of your lives, just watching it. It's like, the hell is happening here?
We're in the bridge of Angry Old Man, and Billy's just looking at me going, we're dead. What are we going to do? You know? And it wasn't until he made the announcement of like, there's people cheering in the back. We're going to be this loud. We may even get louder. This is the way we do it in America. If it's too loud for you, you go in the back, but give those people in the back your seats, your tickets for the seat. The soldiers would push people down. That's why the whole you're ruining my show thing, and he flipped the piano. Because every time the lights went on to film, the soldiers would come over and push the people back in their seats. By the end of that tour, the soldiers were on stage throwing their hats off. To go there now, cool them out, you know?
One of my favorite albums, the reason I got into Billy Joel was Stormfront. That was introduced to me as a young child.
Late. You're young.
I was young. You know, I'm only, now I'm 42, but, music was not really introduced to me until like later in my years, you know what I mean? Because I grew up in a strict Hispanic household, so... You know, listening to the music was not, if it wasn't Spanish music, I wasn't listening to music at all. So a friend of mine introduced me to Billy Joel with the Stormfront album. And actually, one of my favorite songs was always Down Easter Alexa. And the drumming on that song, I know, was just so powerful. And I wanted to know what that meant for you and Billy for that song, because this was one of my number one songs in that album, I felt.
Yeah, it's a great song. It was written because of the problem that the fishermen we're having out on the end of Long Island. And the Alexa is really a boat.
Okay.
It's the body shape, the hull shape is to call it Downeaster. It's a fishing boat where the front is short. And then there's the bridge where you sit and drive. And then the back is really long.
Okay.
So you can fish off it. I made the maiden voyage with him when he bought it up in Maine. And we came all the way back to Long Island. And we docked it in different towns every time we wanted to stop, and it got late. He didn't want to drive at night. And he would go into a hotel, and I would sleep on the boat. It was really cool. I mean, going in the fog, and we have the Loran telling us, there's nothing out there. Wait, there's something out there. We're looking for a bell, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm at the front of the boat in the fog, just looking, and I go like this. I go, we got it. It's right here.
That's awesome.
You know, it was like that. So yeah, the Downeaster Alexa, when he came in and said, we're going to record this, it was like, I want it to sound like a boat. I want it, you know, they were in the water and it's a boat. And I started to do like something like a Jimmy Buffett kind of thing. And he goes, no. That water's too blue. You know, let's go. We're in the ocean, you know? So I came up with the idea of what a diesel engine sounds like, because I grew up on Long Island and you could hear the diesel engines when they went out fishing. You hear the pop, 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 you know, and then the waves crashing down, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's how we came up with that whole drum part, you know.
Okay.
And it's funny because when we recorded, we had Mick Jones was producing Stormfront, Mick Jones from Foreigner.
Yes.
And he was a fan of mine, you know, before we went in the studio. And then, you know, we recorded a couple of songs first. And then after we did Downeaster Alexa, he pressed the button. He goes, that's the Liberty DeVito I've been waiting for.
Nice. You know? Well, We Didn't Start the Fire is one of my ultimate songs, but this one, I knew there was a good story to it.
Yeah. Did you read the Rolling Stone? There was a Rolling Stone article recently where the Red Hot Chili Peppers just put out a song. And the Rolling Stone, the way they start the headline is, the Chili Peppers do, and they say the name of the song, reminiscent of Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire, because he kind of like talks it like Billy did.
Yeah. Oh, really? I have to check that out. I haven't saw it yet. So
it's pretty cool.
Fine, Brian, you did.
Yeah, I have to thank Billy, because in eighth grade for me, when that album was popular, that was one of the few times that they let music become part of education, which I was always a music nerd. So they're like, we want you to do a report on We Didn't Start the Fire. So you'd go and you'd have to take each line of the song and put it into a couple of sentences. So you learned about the entire history of the song. I'm sure that's not what Billy had in mind when he wrote it, but it made for an amazing eighth grade history class for me. So I've always had a little bit of a special smile about that song when I hear it, because it brings me back to that project, which was one of the few times that I was able to actually use music in school in my life. So,
you know, it's funny because I'm in my book, I list all the songs and what I remember from them, from every album. And that song used to be called Jolene. And it was just the melody was just Jolene, won't you take me as I am? You know, Jolene, just an ordinary man. And then it became We Didn't Start the Fire. And he had a book called Chronicles. You know, you see this book, it's really thick, and it lists everything that happened every year. He just went to his birthday because some kid came up to him and says, you know, we got a hard time. Nothing ever happened when you were young. And Billy just kept reading like, oh, yeah. Harry Truman, Doris Day, you know, jumped around so they would rhyme. But, you know, got everything from Chronicles, just went through it.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
That is awesome.
And that is definitely one that from Stormfront on was a staple of pretty much every night, instantly became a staple of all the shows, I assume.
And it's funny because we had done most of the album. I remember we recorded Extremes was the last song that we recorded for the record. And Columbia Records came in, you know, the guys from Sony came in and they listened and they said, well, we hear the second single, but we don't hear a first one yet. And then he wrote We Didn't Start the Fire.
And you know, what always shocked me? That's Not Her Style wasn't a single, because I always thought that one had such a groove to it.
That's a good one.
And such a bombastic opening for an album. It just had some, it had that, like I call the word flip, but that was like Billy Joel, like, I don't want to say angry, but it's, to me, it's kind of like the way No Man's Land starts River of Dreams. It's just this real powerful opening statement. So great way to open an album, kind of like Miami 17 with the album we're talking about tonight.
Yeah.
But now that we veered off a little bit, which I...
Sorry.
No, dude, this is me going full-on nerd here. I'm loving this.
Listen, I go nerd, too, about the Beatles and stuff like that. But, you know, you talk about opening of an album. I think, like, Easy Money opening Innocent Man. It's like, wow!
I don't think there's really a truly bad album opener. That was one thing... Billy always got the sequel. If it was Billy's idea or if it was the label or the band working together, I always felt the albums were always sequenced in the right way.
That was between Billy and Phil Ramone.
And I think those conversations went well because the stories always play out, because I couldn't picture, let's say, Glass House is opening with Close to the Borderline. As much as I love that song is sequenced perfectly on the album.
Yeah.
So
it's in the right spot. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, well, exactly.
You open an album with Breaking Glass. How could you? Yeah, you can't miss.
Of course. All right. So now we'll go back into Songs in the Attic. Liberty, you had for your track three, Everybody Loves You Now. Gomez, what do you have for track three?
So track three, Say Goodbye to Hollywood. I love this song. I wasn't much of a live guy either. I've always loved the studio album. But when I heard this, it was just, wow, I wish I had the opportunity to see you play with Billy. I wish I did. Unfortunately, I did not have that opportunity growing up, but I wish I heard you play live, because when I hear this album, I hear your passion with the drums. I wish this song was on my episode 17, but I'm glad I saved it for tonight, because the live version was so much better than the studio version. I hate to say that because I love the studio version too, but the live, you just brought it to life with it. You know what I mean? So for me, track three, Say Goodbye to Hollywood.
Good one. Where do you live?
I live in New Jersey. We both do, me and Brian. I'm in Morris County.
We're playing close to you, the Lords, and we do the song.
Gomez, I was going to save that for later in the show, but while we're on it, the Lords of 52nd Street will be at the Morristown Impact in June, and we have to be there.
Yes. We will be there. I know
we
I will
be there.
So. We're there. We'll be there.
Awesome. Nice. So Say Goodbye to Hollywood was actually introduced to me. My third cassette that I ever got was Billy Joel's Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2. And that was the live version was on that cassette. I did not go backwards to Songs in the Attic until I got a little bit older. So to me, I didn't even realize there was a studio version. I always thought this was the version because it was one of the singles from the album. However, there are two songs that I chose for my 3 and 4 that I like a little bit more in the grand scheme of this album. So unfortunately, it did not make my list, but with zero disrespect to it because it is such a kick-ass song.
It is.
Liberty, did Say Goodbye to Hollywood make your list?
No, it didn't. Even though, yeah, it's a great song. And, you know, I know that Ronnie Spector had done, you know, that's us being Ronnie Spector. And at the end of the recorded version, when he says, "Hey, DeVito, where you going?" You know, on the fade, was like, I was watching him do the vocal and I just got up to go to the bathroom and he said, "Hey, DeVito, where you going?" You know, and he thought it sounded so New York that he left it in there. And then the live at Carnegie Hall, he says, "Good night, Mrs. DeVito. Good night, Mr. DeVito. And good night, Mr. Cannata, Mrs. Cannata," you know. So it was really cool that he did that. And Ronnie Spector did the tune. And I played with Ronnie for a couple of years after I parted with Billy. And we did the song, you know. She always said, "Oh, Billy Joel wrote that for me." He didn't write it for her. He just wrote it.
he just wrote it.
But the great thing was, it's the same beat as Be My Baby. You know, it's that same boom, 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 blah, you know. And then right before Hal Blaine passed away, who played drums on Be My Baby, I got to play at a NAMM show out in L.A., Be My Baby with Hal Blaine.
Oh,
So that was really cool to do that whole full circle thing.
From one legend to another there.
Yeah, that was cool.
All right. Well, moving on to my track 3. This is my favorite Billy Joel song of all time. And it's track 8 on the album, recorded July 5th, 1980 at the Spectrum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This song is very important to Billy's catalog, as it's the song that in 1972 he performed at Sigma Studios and got the attention of a lot of record labels because of it being played on WMMR. That song is Captain Jack. This song has always been a favorite of mine. And there's something, I love the studio version. Absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite songs. Every time I go to shoot pool, I don't know why, but I put this song on. It just feels like a song that you want to chill out and shoot a couple rounds of pool, and this is a good song to play. Okay. But this version that you recorded in Philadelphia, maybe it's because of the fact that Philadelphia broke this song and there's a connection there. There is an energy in this song that is just undescribable. And I would like to know from you, Liberty, if this song took on a new life in Philadelphia because of that reason.
The only place we played that song was in Philadelphia. Only place we played it. We didn't play it anywhere else. You know, so because we knew that that was the song that Ed Shockey played, and it wasn't our version, it was a live version that he played of the band that was with Billy before us. Yeah, so we play it for the people of Philadelphia, which for them, you know. But, you know, because they're all out there and they're all waiting for it. So you play it like I beat the drums like they owe me money, you know. So
I had the luck of not in Philadelphia one time on the 12 Gardens tour.
Yeah.
The night I went, he played it the one time during that run. And I literally was welling up hearing it live for the first time. It just hit me because it's such a favorite of mine. When I first heard the piano, I'm like, "You gotta be kidding me. I'm finally hearing it live." Like, yes. The only other live Billy Joel moment that means more to me was the night that I took my parents to see him at Madison Square Garden in the, I want to say it was the late 90s. And they played "Goodnight Saigon," and my father's a Vietnam veteran, and he stood at attention the entire song with tears in his eyes. And Billy brought up a bunch of first responders onto the stage to sing along. And I looked at I was bawling my eyes out because you looked around the garden, every military person was standing at attention during the song. I'm getting goosebumps just telling the story. It was such a powerful, beautiful, harmonious moment. And music needs more of that in life now. So that was just another, sorry, I sidetracked there. But
you sidetracked to another great album. Actually, Niall and Curtin is probably my favorite of all the albums that we've done. Niall and Curtin is probably my favorite one. And Goodnight Saigon was, it's funny because when we did the song, the basic part of the song was written for the album before it, which was Innocent Man was before Niall and Curtin, right?
Glass Houses.
Yeah, so we kind of rehearsed it, but Billy didn't have any lyrics, no idea. He just had the beginning piano part and the wee, the bridge part. Mm-hmm. But then when we did it for Niall and Curtin and we played it for people that came in the studio, everybody knew somebody that was lost in Vietnam and mm-hmm. People cried when they listened to it in the studio. So we knew we really had something. And when we all sang the part, we will all go down together. It was funny. You can really hear Phil Ramone's voice. It's the deep one. We will all go down, and I yell out, "Oh, you're all right, Sarge," to make it like we were like really the guys, but we weren't. And the reason why we did it was because I had to go for my draft physical. I got the notice, it's like time. I was 19 years old at the time of Vietnam. And this was 1969. It was at its peak. I mean, I write in a book that like 300 and something guys got killed that day. And Billy didn't get drafted for some reason, not my business to talk about. But, the guys in the band, we didn't go. And when we saw our friends, I had a friend, George Christensen, I went to high school with. And he used to sit at the end of the bar when he came home. And he had ears around his neck of the Viet Cong. It was like, this is the craziest thing. So that was our tribute to them, like thanking them and like feeling bad. And I remember telling somebody, we didn't go and we feel bad that we didn't go. And the guy, the Vietnam vets all said the same thing to us. It's like, you're better off that you didn't. You're lucky we didn't. Don't feel bad that you didn't go. It wasn't that kind of war. It was like these boys were thrown into something that was just a horror show.
I've heard some stories from my father, and he said, Brian, he's like, listen to the lyrics in Goodnight Saigon. It's so true. He goes, I can't listen to it and not be brought back. The lyrics tell the story so well. It's autobiographical for so many people that Billy never met. And to me, that was something that every time I hear that song, and my father's still with us, I still shoot pool with him on Monday nights.
Great. Great.
And every time the song comes on, I literally get goosebumps because I think about how much that night it resonated with him. And I just looked around the audience and seeing the various people standing up at attention through the whole song. It was just a beautiful moment. And so thank you for being a part of that beautiful moment, because I know how much it resonates with my father as well as me. So as a pivot there again, back to Captain Jack. Did Captain Jack make your list?
No, Captain Jack did not make my list.
Okay, Gomez, did Captain Jack make your list?
Captain Jack did make my list. It's what I closed out my list with, actually.
All right.
I actually talked about it on episode 17. It was actually my track 8 on that list. So for me, I talked about it a lot there. But again, when we're talking about the studio version on that show, and then I'm talking about Songs of the Attic on this show, again, it's the drumming. You hear the passion, again, Liberty, that you have for the songs. And it just resonates and it shows in the music in the live version. And I got to say, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because I tell you, if it wasn't for the musicianship that you have for the drums and the passion, I don't know how good the music would be. But I tell you, it's unbelievable.
Well, thanks.
For me, I ended my track 4 with Captain Jack.
And Gomez closes out first. That doesn't happen very often. So
it does not happen. It does not happen often. But for tonight to say thank you to Liberty and for the great songs and everything, for me, this is a great way to end it for me. So I'm excited.
All right. Well, we've now got 2 track 4s left. Gomez was Captain Jack. Liberty, what did you close with tonight?
Okay. I was torn between 2, but now my 2 choices were either Summer Highland Falls or Street Life Serenata. Now, why I say Street Life is because I think it's a really a dynamic tune. But I think Summer Highland Falls was the first song. Billy came in with that song in the studio when we did the studio version on Turnstiles. And he came in with it and he just had part of it. And that was the first time that me and Doug looked at him and goes, you have to go home and finish that. That's really good. And it was the first time I actually had to go home and get a dictionary out and look at some of the words like he was singing. You know? So I just have a very passionate feeling about that song, you know, because most relationships are sadness or euphoria. It's either one or the other. You know, you go from one to the other, no matter if it's between the two of you or something outside of the relationship happens and you both get sad for a second. You know, it's like it's that battle all the time. And his lyrics are brilliant on that one. I mean, that's the first one that like really boom. But then Streetlight, it's very musical, you know, but I have to go with Summer Highland Falls. That's going to be the one.
That's awesome. A great choice.
Well, it didn't make Gomez's list.
No, it did not.
No.
And now I have to, after that soliloquy, I almost want to make it my track four, but I'm going to go with the excuse of I'm so excited that we're going to get to talk about an extra song. I went with something different so we could. I'm actually going to say it didn't make my list, but I'm glad we got to hear that story because now I get to hear a story about another song from the album. And my track four was recorded at Madison Square Garden on June 24th, 1980, the same night that Miami 2017 was recorded. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this was probably one of the most ambitious songs that Billy had recorded up until this time. And this was from the Piano Man album originally. And I'm going with the Ballad of Billy the Kid. This live version takes the song to just such new heights. And if you look at setlist.fm, and I've, as a music nerd, I've scrolled through the years and looked at his concert set lists over the years. Billy the Kid was not a staple that was played all the time. It would get sprinkled in every now and then.
Right.
Certain shows. I think he did it at the Shea Stadium when he closed it down. But every time it comes out, it gets like this insanely positive reaction. So to me, it's like an underrated gem, kind of the, I don't know. I don't want to use the word progressive because there's just something about the song. It's almost like a theatrical presentation. It's like a story being told. It feels like a musical movie, if that makes any sense, between the opening with the piano and then it kicks in. And again, the drums in this version drive the song the way I hear it in Everybody Loves You Now and on future releases like we talked about, Angry Young Man. I hear a lot of the stuff that you're doing to kind of drive the tune where it's going. I'm just curious. This is a deep cut, so you didn't play it all the time. When it did come out, was that refreshing to you guys, having to play Piano Man, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, You May Be Right, every single night? Were these curveball songs something that kind of was a breath of fresh air after a very long tour where you're playing kind of similar songs each night? Because you have to play the hits. So I kind of wanted to end on a little bit of a deeper cut note as an homage to the fact that it is definitely not one that most people go to. But to me, it's such a standout song on the album. So I would love to hear your thoughts on it. And if this was something that would be refreshing to break out every now and then for you guys.
Well, now, what did Gomez pick?
Gomez closed with Captain Jack.
Okay, so Captain Jack, Billy the Kid, Summer Highland Falls, three songs that were not singles.
Nope.
So there you go. I mean, we're closing out with, you know, some pretty good ones. I mean, Billy the Kid, you know, it's funny, Billy the Kid. I called up Richie Cannata and I said, I'm doing this podcast and I had to listen to Songs in the Attic again to refresh my memory of it. And I told him, I said, oh, we were good, man. We were really good. And he said, yeah, we were really good. I said, but I have to say, I think the Lords of 52nd Street do Billy the Kid better than we did it on this record.
Ooh. You get me more excited for Morristown by the minute now. I'm telling you, Liberty.
Also, this could be why Angry Young Man isn't on the album, because they're kind of similar. the breaks, bam, 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 you know, dun, 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 you know.
I feel a connection between those two songs.
Yes, yes.
And I'm using the word progressive, and that's probably not the word I want to use, but Billy had roots in progressive when he was with Attila. So
yes,
I felt like there was prog elements, not like Genesis and Rush prog, but some style elements that were incorporated into his sound with these songs.
Yeah, he loved Yes. He liked that kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, they're both stories. One is this guy that is going to be angry for the rest of his life, you know? And the other one is a great story because I love the way he ties in the end about being the kid with a six pack in his hand, you know, rather than the six gun, you know?
Right.
True.
Which is really cool. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, now's the time that we each get to go through our playlists one by one. So the people, because we've talked about so many songs tonight, at this point, people forgot what our tracks were. So Liberty, right, why don't you go through your track list, track one through track four, so everybody can hear your four songs in their entirety.
Okay, here we go. Miami 2017, number one. Los Angelinos was number two. Everybody Loves You Now was number three. And Summer Holland Falls, number four.
Gomez.
Track one, Miami 2017. Track two, Everyone Loves You Now. Track three, Say Goodbye to Hollywood. And track four, Captain Jack.
All right. And mine was track one, Miami 2017. Track two, Everybody Loves You Now. Track three, Captain Jack. And track four, The Ballad of Billy the Kid. We had a rarity on the show tonight. We had a bingo with Miami 2017 as track one. And we also had a trifecta with Everybody Loves You Now. But beyond that, the playlists go in different directions. So yeah. Playlisters, it's time for you to head over to playlistwarspodcast.com, visit the Billy Joel Songs in the Attic playlist and album page, and vote for which one of us you think got it right. Now, Liberty, in 2020, you released a memoir entitled Liberty, Life, Billy, and the Pursuit of Happiness. We mentioned it at the top of the show. Can you kind of give people a little bit of a preview about a little bit more what you talk about in the book?
Well, the reason why I wrote the book in the beginning, I started out as a family history for my kids, you know, but then when I parted ways with Billy, I thought, oh, I'm going to write about, you know, my time with Billy, but I'm not the kind of guy that wants to throw anybody under the bus, you know, because people said when me and Billy parted ways, they were like, what is he, crazy? Let you go? You know where the bodies are buried, you know? But I didn't want to do that. Now, the thing that really made me do it the way I did it was I don't like American Idol. I don't like those kind of shows because people think that you go on, you sing a song, you get a record deal, and you become famous. No, it doesn't have. There's a lot of dues to pay. Mm-hmm. So that's why I start from how did my grandparents came from Italy. Two generations later, one of their offspring is now playing with one of the biggest single artists in the world. How did that happen? So I go from the beginning of my family, how I grew up, to every band that I played in that got me to the point of playing with Billy. And so it's like a history of how I got there. And, you know, there's two roads that run parallel with each other. One is the one that you know, the great one, like, oh, you guys are so successful and everything wants to be peachy keen and all that kind of. And the other one is like the dark road, you know, things that we did that you shouldn't have done, people that died, like Doug took his own life, you know, after he parted ways with Billy. And so it talks about everything, the good parts and the downside. You know, so that's basically what the book is about. And then me and Billy making up because he wrote the foreword.
And I'm so glad that happened because, you know, if anything that the last several years have taught us, life's too short to hold grudges. Yep. Keep a smile on your face. Keep those loved ones, the people that you shared those bonds and memories with, keep them in a good place because that's the important thing in life is the relationships and the time you spend with people. And to not leave things on a bad note, leave things on a positive. And I'm so happy that you guys were able to build back that friendship because that is something that the music, you can't take that away, but that bond will always be there between you guys. And I think that's amazing.
And you know, it's funny because every time I talk to somebody and they know that me and Billy are talking again, the question is, do you think you're ever going to play with them again? And it's like, that's not an issue. I mean, it's like, I don't really want to. And, you know, that's done. We did all that kind of stuff. You know, well, if he asked you to play at Madison Square Garden and sit in, would you do it? No, I wouldn't. I would do it with the Lords and Billy. But to sit in, you know, like I said, I didn't throw anybody under the bus, but there's still like some bad blood that, you know, with other people that are involved right. with Billy now. And so, no, I wouldn't do it. So when we met, it wasn't about that I wanted my gig back or he was going to ask me to play. It was just these two friends that looked in each other's eyes for 30 years mm-hmm. playing live and in the studio to connect to see where we're going next in a song. And that's all it was about. We didn't even talk about music. We talked more about people that we knew who passed away, who was sick, who's still around, what are we doing, you know, like that kind of stuff. It was just friends meeting.
And that's awesome.
Standing on a bridge with troubled waters just going underneath it and, you know.
Let bygones be bygones. And that's a beautiful thing, man.
Yeah.
So this year, we talked about it earlier. You're on the road with the Lords of 52nd Street. Can you maybe talk about how that project came together and what people can expect on the road and what we can expect when we come out to see you in Morristown this June?
Well, you know, in I forget what year it was, but we were inducted into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame. Myself, Richie, Russell, and the late Doug Stegmaier. And I was still not talking to Billy. So when I was asked if I would go to the induction, I was like, no, I don't want to go. I'm not going. I was done. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine from the drum company called me up and he goes, do you really want to go back there again? You know, because I was talking to a life coach to get over it. You know, the anger and all everything that was going on. But for Russell and Richie, I did go. They asked us to play a song, you know, so we knew which song we were going to play. We played that song. The crowd went crazy. We ended up playing like 5 songs that night. Somebody, Ron Delsner, who books Madison Square Garden, you know, the big guy, he said he was in the audience because he got inducted into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame that same night. He said, you guys are so great. Why aren't you doing this? There are so many bands that are playing your music. You're the real guys. You should be doing it. So that's why we put it together. You know, we got this great singer. We had one in the beginning, and now we have another one. Dan Orlando is his name. He's younger than we are, and he's got that. He sounds like the high voice Billy, the one that has the higher voice, you know, the powerful one. You know, because Billy has dropped all the keys to his songs.
Yes.
He can't hit those notes anymore. You know, he's worn himself out. I mean, how long has he been singing those songs? So, but we do the songs in the original key.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's me and Russell and Richie. So you're getting more guys that were in the original band in the original key. And we sound more like Billy than Billy does. And we do the stuff that people really loved is the Stranger, the 52nd Street, the Glass, that time period. You know, we do extremes sometimes and you know, stuff from other stuff, Good Night Saigon, we do. You know, we've done a bunch of different songs, but people love that earlier time, that earlier period. The Stranger, Zanzibar, yes. We do sometimes, you know, that kind of, yeah.
So can I put a request in for Angry Young Man in Morristown?
Sure, we'll see. We'll see how I feel.
Well, Liberty, to say that this has been an honor would be the understatement of a lifetime for me. Decades-long fan and many more to come. Thank you for the music that you've brought to my life. And thank you even more for being a guest. This has truly been a once-in-a-lifetime experience for me. Thank you, thank you, thank you for coming on our show tonight.
Well, you know, it's been so much fun because it's not like other podcasts that I've done. Usually it's the same questions over and over again. You know, this was interesting. You made me go back and listen to songs in the attic. And there's that stupid picture of me. I can't stand it. This one here, that one. You know, that's what happens when you fool around. All of a sudden, though, history. It's history.
Oh, man.
I didn't even know where I got those glasses.
Oh, man. Well, I can't thank you enough, Liberty. Like Brian said, once a lifetime opportunity to talk to you. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time out to talk to me and Brian, especially with the music. And when we say legendary drummer, we do mean it, because you are a true legend. Brian, as the co-host, the anchor of the show, as I say, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Brian, for everything you do to make the show excellent. And I want to thank all the playlisters listening. When you have a chance, vote on PlaylistWarsPodcast.com. Also, don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com/PlaylistWars. And wait till next week when a new battle takes place on Playlist Wars. Good night, everybody.
You can find Playlist Wars on Facebook and Twitter at Playlist Wars, on Instagram at Playlist Wars Podcast, on email at PlaylistWars@gmail.com, or via voicemail at 201-644-6498. That's 201-644-6498. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave a 5-star review and be sure to tell a friend or multiple friends about the show. Until next time, thanks for listening.